This is an ABC podcast.
Suppliers, right through to retailers, have now gone through their second winter with effectively a non-event. We can deal with no snow years, but to take 2 years' worth of income away from people is an impossible task to ask them to survive.
After a second COVID-interrupted ski season, Australia's snow industry contemplates its future. That story soon. And Launceston's Olympic golden girl, Ariane Titmus, heads back to where it all started and is celebrated by the community.
I'm very honoured to receive the keys to the city. It's very humbling that Launceston and Tassie still claim me. And I mean, I'm born and bred here and I had a great childhood in Launceston.
I'm Alex Hyman and this is Australia Wide. Firstly tonight, it sounds crazy, but there is evidence that human bones taken from regional Australia are being sold online. The revelation has come from an ongoing research project tracking the removal of the skeletons of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people during the 19th and 20th centuries. Thousands of body parts, including skulls and hair samples, remain in museum and university collections in Australian cities and overseas. It's a deeply hurtful situation for Aboriginal Australians who are trying their best to get their remains of their ancestors returned for reburial. ABC Kimberley reporter Erin Park has today published a story about the research project, revealing evidence that a black market in the body parts is continuing online, and a warning: Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders may find some aspect of this distressing. Erin, thanks for speaking to Australia Wide. Firstly, how did it come about that human remains from Australia ended up overseas?
Well, this was actually occurring over about a 200-year period, it's thought, Alex. I've been keeping in very close contact over the last decade with the team at the Kimberley Aboriginal Law and Culture Centre on this topic, and it's quite extraordinary. There were basically thousands of sets of human remains that were removed from Australia and the Torres Strait Islands, mainly during the sort of 19th and 20th centuries. So if we think about what was going on then in regional areas, there were pastoralists, even agricultural workers that might have been collecting bones that they found. Often in traditional burials, there would have been bones that were tucked into caves or up in trees or in the sand dunes. And these were sort of being pilfered and taken as souvenirs. And then there were researchers who were coming around in a more organised way with the purpose of trying to collect human remains. Because if we think about the context at the time, there was a lot of study going on, anthropologists and so on, that were interested in the attributes, I guess, of Indigenous people from different parts of the planet. So there was a trade occurring all across the globe in hair samples and bones. Skulls were very sought after that were then used for sometimes scientific study or sold to what were known as gentlemen collectors, who actually prided themselves on having these pretty morbid collections of human remains to display and show off. One of the people that we spoke to for this story is Dr. Lyndon Orman-Parker, and he described to me the circumstances in which some of these human remains were taken overseas.
She came across very disturbing stories and cases of Aboriginal people being sent overseas or into institutional collections against the wishes of their loved ones and family. And so some of these individuals passed away of natural causes, but of course quite a few passed away due to colonial frontier conflicts and were often sent overseas as well. So because of this thirst for knowledge about the new colonies, this then became a trade.
So thousands of these sets of human remains, Alex, have ended up in the collections of some of the biggest cultural institutions in the world, and they are still there. So places like the British Museum, there's traditional owners from the Broome area where I am, the Yarra people, that are trying at the moment to negotiate the return of those human remains. Of course, as you flagged, it's a very distressing situation for local families who just want to have the remains of their ancestors returned to them so that they can repatriate them, return them, rebury them on their traditional country.
And Erin, what is the latest information about the number of bodies still to be repatriated?
Well, the latest information, the audits that have been done, have revealed that there are about 2,000 sets of human remains from Australia and the Torres Strait Islands currently located overseas, and about 5,000 within institutions in Australia. Of that figure, though, of the human remains in Australia, about half of those are thought to actually be hair samples, because there were some scientists that really, you know, made a concerted effort to collect the hair of thousands of people, and so that sort of sits a little bit separately to the skeletons, which is the more disturbing sort of part of this. These figures have come to light because there's been an increasing amount of attention paid to this in recent years. There's been a national research project, the Return, Reconcile and Renew project, that's been led by ANU, but has actually had researchers from all around the world and different Australian universities working with Aboriginal groups. So here in the Kimberley, in the Torres Strait, in South Australia, and they've actually been creating detailed online databases to track where the ancestral remains have ended up. And that's all, I guess, with the aim of trying to empower Aboriginal communities to lobby to get them returned.
Your story that's on the ABC News website reveals that skeletons from Australia are potentially still being sold online. What can you tell us about that?
I was actually shocked when I heard this. I just was doing a routine check-in with the researchers earlier this year to see how that project was going. And it turns out that they had just collected enough information to trigger a separate follow-up study that now is going to focus on exactly what you mentioned there, the trade that has occurred in human remains around the planet and the degree to which it is continuing now. The research that they've done so far has found advertisements by auction houses basically promoting, we have 50 skulls of people from this area, and this is distressing to hear, but saying that these Indigenous groups are dying out, and therefore the cash value of these skulls is only going to increase. So a very sort of dark commodification of human remains. The question, though, is how much has this continued? Obviously, through the last sort of 50, 80 years, there's been a lot of different legislation that's come into effect as times have changed to try to stamp out the sale of human remains. But the disturbing thing is there's evidence it's continuing. And that's been facilitated by sales websites such as eBay, who have publicly stated, the researchers say, that they have policies in place to ban the sale of the bones of Indigenous people. But there's evidence that that is still slipping through. So the researchers that I've spoken to, they say they've actually already found evidence of one very recent advertisement from overseas of a Torres Strait Islander person's remains being advertised, and that's really surprised a lot of people and has now attracted $750,000 research funding from the Australian Research Council so that they can spend 3 years really taking a deep dive to work out exactly what's going on.
And you've spoken to some Indigenous people about this, two local people there in the Kimberley. How do they feel about what they're hearing here?
I was able to go out to Fitzroy Crossing and sit down with the directors of the Kimberley Aboriginal Law and Culture Centre as they were getting a project update and being briefed on this new research project about the remains still being for sale. And they were horrified and they were very saddened. It's not an academic exercise, I suppose, in any way for them. It's a very personal thing that they feel very deeply. Neil Carter is a Gidja and Gooniyandi man, for example, who's worked in the repatriations area for about a decade. And here is how he put it into words.
It's still going on. You can even look online and buy Aboriginal remains online.
So you're glad this work's going to be done?
I'm really glad that this is going to be done. It's just for our dignity and our healing and our reconciliation and just to put a spotlight on these thieves that took away our ancestral remains and got paid.
So that's Neil Carter from the Kimberley Aboriginal Law and Culture Centre there. And he's actually come out of retirement, Alex, because when this project was commissioned, he just thought, you know what, he's getting on a little bit, Neil, but he was like, you know, this is so important, not just to my, you know, to his Gidja Gooniyandi people, but also more broadly, nationally, that that this trade is shut down. So he's now come out of retirement to work as a special researcher on the project. It's early days, but definitely going to be keeping in touch with them over the next couple of years as they work out exactly what is being sold where.
It certainly sounds like Neil's got some work there ahead of him. Kimberley reporter Erin Park there in Broome. Thanks so much for speaking to Australia Wide.
Thanks, Alex.
You're listening to Australia Wide. on ABC Radio.
That's right. You are listening to Australia Wide with me, Alex Hyman, in for Sinead Mangan. Great to have your company. And remember, you can always email the program. We'd love to hear what's happening in your part of the world. AustraliaWide.radio at abc.net.au. That's AustraliaWide.radio at abc.net.au. Looking at the nation's ski and snow industries now. After two consecutive winters with limited domestic trade and no international tourists, leading industry experts say Australia's snow industry is on the brink of collapse. Bega reporter Brianna Holden reports.
Contributing an estimated $2 billion to the Australian economy annually and employing around 20,000 regional jobs, Snow Sports Industries Australia Chairman Edward Forty says from small city retailers right through to accommodation providers and large resorts, the entire industry is under threat.
As it stands now, suppliers right through to retailers have now gone through their second winter with effectively a non-event. We're pretty resilient. We can deal with no snow years, but to take 2 years' worth of income away from people is an impossible task to ask them to survive. There's going to be some collateral damage, I think, unfortunately.
And while support has been provided, CEO of the National Retail Association, Dominic Lamb, explains the geography-based modelling has failed to acknowledge the national-level network that makes up the entire industry.
We need it to be broadened to anyone that is operating or operating a business, including manufacturing, specifically for the snow industry. So it's not just if you are located in a region. It needs to be broader than that because we know a lot of their distributors actually sit outside of that location but are just as impacted.
As a result, industry experts are calling for the federal government to view the snow industry on the same level as the aviation sector, with a package similar to the Tourism Aviation Network Support Program, as well as asking the New South Wales government to develop an Alpine Resorts winter support package and the Victorian government to broaden their current program to include all off-mountain providers. Otherwise, Dominic Lamb believes livelihoods will be on the line.
Ultimately, we need to have our state governments really take a look at this because we know that there are tens of thousands of regional jobs here at stake.
She says these changes would ensure non-mountain-based businesses are lifted out of a potential collapse. Businesses like Ozski, who rely heavily on the sale of snow apparel and equipment online and outside the Alpine regions, with Ozski owner Neil Ritchie explaining the current support modelling sees him miss out on significant portions of aid.
In our city store, we're down over 90%, so it's really just about survival, and most snow retailers are doing the same thing, and it's like, how do we survive and how do we still have our businesses intact and our staff on board when all this starts to rebound again, which is not until June, July next year?
And according to Edward Forty, the seasonal nature of the industry means snow businesses are taking a bigger hit than other sectors.
We have 10 to 12 weeks worth of trade each year. So when we come out of lockdown in Sydney, in Melbourne, they will have no trade because the winter has now passed. So that leaves them with 9 months waiting for the next time that they can start welcoming people back into their stores.
Neil Ritchie says unless there is immediate policy change, the situation will remain dire.
There's going to be a lot who won't be there. So, you know, as people are heading to the snow next year, they're going to have a lot less choice unless we do something to save them. And we're going to do it now. So we just can't leave it.
That's Neil Ritchie, the owner of Ozski. He was speaking there with Bega reporter Brianna Holden.
This week on Landline, how much should wool growers be levied to fund the Australian Wool Innovation Organisation? Also, Australian farmers' growing love of chickpeas. And meet Max Bergman, a passionate camel farmer and scientist who is also legally blind.
I'm just normal. Well, I've got a disability, yeah, but so what? You know, just suck it up and deal with it.
That's Landline, 12:30 Sunday on ABC TV.
And right now you are with me, Alex Hyman, here on Australia Wide. Experts have major concerns. The mouse plague is making a comeback, and the mouse numbers are already so high nationally, they fear it will become even worse than before. Mice are starting to breed rapidly, particularly in warmer districts in Queensland and Western Australia. It's awful news for regional communities and farmers who are growing some of the best crops in years. Dubbo reporter Lucy Thackray filed this report.
Earlier this year, videos of mice pouring out of sheds in their thousands, covering roads and running through homes, horrified people worldwide. Winter has brought a brief reprieve for impacted residents who've already suffered millions of dollars in damage and serious mental health impacts. But now, the worst news possible. CSIRO's mouse expert Steve Henry says mice are being seen in significant numbers in Queensland, New South Wales, Victoria and Western Australia.
So unfortunately we're hearing of higher than normal numbers of mice for this time of the year through a large part of the cropping system from Queensland all the way through New South Wales and into Victoria, Western Victoria and across into Western Australia as well. That's really cause for some concern for us at the moment.
Unfortunately, winter survival means mice are starting the peak breeding season with an already high population. This could see the plague become even worse than the devastating levels experienced earlier this year.
We would expect breeding to start early in the spring if conditions are favourable, and certainly this year is one of those years where conditions are going to be really good. So we would expect to see breeding start relatively early in the springtime and continue through into the summer. So what we're saying to farmers is get out, go for a walk through your paddocks, look for those signs of damage, and cereals, that's where mice are chewing into the nodes of the developing heads, but also in early maturing canola crops and in some legumes, you'll see damage to the pods and flowers. So look for those signs of damage and be prepared to bait early, hopefully before the population starts to rise too dramatically, and that will help us take the breeding potential out of the population.
Cameron Durbridge is an agronomist in Gundawindi. He says mice have been quite a consistent problem for over a year.
This time last year, and they were doing quite a bit of damage, and they haven't really disappeared. There's hot spots around. I wouldn't say they're getting into crops all over our region, but they're definitely there. It's just a matter of time as they breed up and the crops get a bit more mature and push towards closer to harvest, where that might favour them starting to do a bit of chewing.
The South Queensland agronomist says there are already signs of crop damage around the region.
The first signs of it is when the crop's out in head, and then all of a sudden you'll see all these white heads that have died off. They're chewing through that tiller or stem, if you'd like to call it, chewing through the node. And, a few days later that whole head and tiller becomes white.
He's shocked at the resilience of mice through wet and cold conditions.
I'm just surprised that they got through a flood back in March and April. And I think they turned up here last year towards the end of July or early August, and we've been putting up with them since then. The horrific last summer in our sorghum or summer crops. We had a pretty major flood here at the end of March, early April. We've had our usual amount of frost, I would think, for winter, and usually that sort of cleans them up, but this year it has not. I don't know what we do.
Meantime, in nearby Mungindi, agronomist Michael Brosnan says mice are being seen in much higher numbers than is usual for early spring.
Yeah, they're certainly higher than last year. The damage was a lot earlier. That's probably because the numbers have been higher. They've been able to overwinter at a higher level.
He says farmers are taking this very seriously to try and protect their crops.
It's a big concern. Yeah, we're very conscious of it, especially, we finally got a reasonable crop and reasonable prices. We're not mucking around if we think there is an issue where we're just getting in and baiting.
This message is echoed by Steve Henry from the CSIRO, who's urging farmers not to be complacent, even if they think they don't have mice.
So look for those signs of damage and be prepared to bait early, hopefully before the population starts to rise too dramatically, and that will help us take the breeding potential out of the population.
That's the CSIRO's mouse expert, Steve Henry, ending that report from our reporter in the New South Wales Western Plains, Lucy Thackray. And you can read more on Lucy's story on the ABC News website. Head to abc.net.au/news.
We are one.
But we are many. ABC Radio is here with you.
When times are tough.
When you want to share your local stories and want to connect with your community.
We are your local voice.
ABC Radio is here with you.
And right now you're with me, Alex Hyman, on Australia Wide. Australian swimming sensation Ariane Titmus is back home in the state where her career started, inspiring others to dream big. Fresh from winning two gold, a silver and a bronze medal at the recent Tokyo Olympics, the 21-year-old's hometown of Launceston has been throwing her a hero's welcome. Monica Champ reports from the pool, which helped springboard Ariane's career.
When I walked in here today, it was very crazy for me to think probably next time I'm here there's going to be my name in here.
That's Olympic freestyle swimmer Ariane Titmus. The 21-year-old is back in her hometown of Launceston in northern Tasmania. She's been coaching junior swimmers at the Launceston Aquatic Centre, which is where she swam as a junior before moving to Brisbane 6 years ago. The centre's 50-metre competition pool will soon be named in her honour.
I guess to have my name here forever, it's such an honour for me. I think out of all the accolades, having a pool renamed after you is something that's still very crazy for me to think about. I mean, this is the pool where I guess my swimming career kind of took off, and I did the training here before I moved away, so I'm very grateful for the opportunity to have the pool renamed after me.
And you've obviously been coaching here today, whereas when you were last here, you must have been in the pool being coached by someone else. How does it feel to now be in the coach role?
Yeah, I had to actually think about the drills that I wanted to do today and try to think what was important for me as a swimmer, and I think that to teach that to the little kids down here, that I think coming from me, someone they probably look up to, I think if I'm telling them, hopefully they really take on board what I've said.
What are some of those tips?
So I tried to tell them about how important their elbow position is, about their hip movement and not letting their hips move, and really just overall the importance of practicing the small things in freestyle. It's very easy for when you're swimming slow to forget about your technique, so I tried to tell them to always practice good technique even when you're swimming slow.
This is the first time Titmus has been back in Launceston since she captivated the world at the recent Tokyo Olympics, where she won two gold, one silver and a bronze medal.
Hi, I'm Jo from Swimming Tasmania and I'm the Athlete Development Officer. We're absolutely thrilled just for Ariane to give up her time to come back to grassroots swimming in Tasmania, just to inspire the children. Who else to learn from but an Olympic champion, so it's wonderful.
And what does this mean for Tassie, just the fact that we've got such a success story that's grown up here and then gone and made it in the big time?
I think it just proves that Tasmania has the athlete potential, just proves that anything's possible. You dream big, hard work, motivation, determination. I think anything is possible for any athlete in any sport.
It feels a bit weird to be back because nothing's changed. Launceston's very much the same place it was when I lived here. So it's a bit bizarre for me. I went back to my old school, primary school this morning, Sacred Heart, and it was like I was back at school. Nothing much had changed. And seeing my old teachers was, really surreal. But it feels nice to be back. I kind of love the small community that it is here, and I'm excited for the week ahead.
Junior swimmers hoping to follow in Ariane's footsteps are just as excited to have their role model home.
I would really like to go far in my swimming. I'd like to go to the Olympics, hopefully one day.
I aspire to be like Ariane because I'm a distance swimmer, so it's like a really special opportunity for me.
A great opportunity to have Ariane Titmus coaching. I'm hoping to go to the Olympics when I'm older.
You've obviously become an inspiration and a role model for a lot of these young kids. What advice would you give them going forward?
I think something that I've always said is I've always believed in myself as an athlete and a person, and even though I come from Launceston, which is a very small place compared to Brisbane where I live now, I think anything's possible if you set your mind to it, and I said that to anyone who's here or anyone around the country who dreams big.
The week of hometown celebrations will culminate in a city celebration on Friday. Titmus will be presented with Launceston's highest honour, a key to the city. While it's only a symbolic gesture recognising outstanding national or international achievement, it's awarded to only few. Titmus will be the sixth Launceston hometown hero to receive a key, joining the likes of Richie Port and Daniel Gill, and she'll be the first woman.
Friday's going to be huge. I'm very honoured to receive the keys to the city. It's very humbling that Launceston and Tassie still claim me. And I mean, I'm born and bred here and I had a great childhood in Launceston. So I feel really grateful to be honoured in that way and I'm looking forward to it.
That's Olympic swimming champion Ariane Titmus returning to where it all began for her in Launceston. And that report was by Manika Champ. And that is Australia Wide for this Wednesday. Remember, you can listen back to the program. You can podcast the show. Just visit our Australia Wide website and you can find it all there. I'm Alex Hyman. Have a wonderful Wednesday evening. I'll catch you again tomorrow. Cheerio.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.